This episode of Current Geek is brought to you by our Patreon at patreon.com/frogpants. Give a little, give a lot, or give a little in between and help this show and others on the Frog Pants Network survive and thrive. That's patreon.com/frogpants.
I have
Current Geek!
Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the proceedings weekly of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars. Geeks of the world and you to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson. That's Tom Merritt. Hi, Tom.
Well, hey, Scott Johnson.
Hey, man.
What are you doing here?
Well, you were in New York last week and now you're not in New York.
I know.
Yeah. How'd that go? Any big tales? Subway tales or anything?
I got to see Iaz.
Yeah. As Ektar, sure.
And I got to see the One World Freedom Tower, whatever. That depends on who you ask what they call it. And I got to see Ewan McGregor.
Oh, goodness. Wait, hold on. Back the truck up. What happened there? What was the...
It was a play. It was a Tom Stoppard play called The Real Thing with Ewan McGregor, Cynthia Nixon of Sex and the City fame, Maggie Gyllenhaal of Batman fame.
Yeah.
And Josh Hamilton, but not the Josh Hamilton who conquered drugs to become a baseball star.
Okay, good. Because I was going to have a real problem with it if it was him. Yeah. No, that's great. Well, congrats on a safe trip home. And join me while we welcome our guest this week. That's right. You heard me say guest, not guests. We have singular in the guests this week. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Voice actor extraordinaire. You know him from things like, the brand new and sort of semi-still recent Shadow of Mordor video game where he plays Gollum. He's a voice in every game you ever play. And I mean that. And probably every English dubbed anime you've ever watched. It's Liam O'Brien. Hello, Liam.
Hello, Scott and Tom. Yes, I guarantee that everybody has shot me in the face at least one time.
You are often that guy, right? Like a Call of Duty dude or somebody to kill.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been around a long time, but sort of like a journeyman. And in the last couple of years, I've kind of climbed a little higher.
I love it, dude. I do. It's a game I play because I'll get the latest title and I'll listen really closely and eventually I'll hear you.
Guess the Liam.
It happens. And I love it. So for fans of the show, there's a lot of carryover from like the instance and some of the other Blizzard focused stuff I do. You would know Liam as the voice of my brain just went dead. Oh, the Scout in StarCraft II. And of course, everyone's favorite dude who wants to kill everybody
Scott,
in the second
expansion.
You sound
like you're not prepared.
I do kind of know. My brain just went dead. Who's the guy in Burning Crusade? What's wrong with me?
Shemp, I think his name
Shemp.
Is
Shemp in the beginning.
Shemp.
Who has got the wings and you are not. What's wrong with me? Anyway, that guy, the Glaive.
Illidan.
Thank you, Storm Rage. Thank you very much. And that is an iconic. That's an iconic thing, dude. That's not a thing gamers forget.
Well, look at these guns. I mean.
Well, very nice.
Easy crossover.
It's super
nice.
Thank
you for having me on. You know, I think I've been on one of your shows one other time before, and that time and this time, I feel like I'm crawling inside the TV and hanging out with Ross and Rachel because I've listened to your shows for so long.
Can Tom be Rachel, or how are we going to work that out?
That's funny because when I was in New York last week, I ate dinner in the building that was used as the facade for Monica's apartment.
Whoa. Really? That wasn't an actual apartment? That was a fake apartment?
Well, you know, they always have an establishing shot, but her actual apartment, I'm sure, was a set, right?
Yeah. And I'm guessing about $9,000 a month if it was real.
Yeah, right.
That's the thing you got to remember. Well, all right. Strap in, everybody, and hang tight. We're about to play the game known as the stuff at the top of the show.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Take me away, Tom.
When is radio going to grow up? Marvel Studios had planned to unveil the teaser trailer for Avengers Age of Ultron during the upcoming episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this week. Then the trailer leaked and Marvel said, damn it, Hydra, on Twitter. They actually did say that. Yeah. Then they switched gears. They released the teaser online. And according to EW.com, sources suspect a culprit in one of the international markets where the trailer was sent for translation. Anyway, forget all that. Let's talk about the trailer. IO9 had a great shot-by-shot breakdown of all the action. Highlights include Iron Man's Hulkbuster armor, Quicksilver moving fast, Scarlet Witch getting all red and witchy, also ballerinas, Andy Serkis showing up in the movie, and a broken Captain America shield. Also, lots and lots of Ultron, as voiced by that guy from The Blacklist.
Like this bit right here. Check it out.
There are no strings on me.
Just doing his Blacklist best, man.
Oh, that's James Spader.
Yeah,
sorry,
what'd you say? Oh, you said...
I said the guy from The Blacklist. Oh, thanks to Captain Kipper for submitting this on the subreddit, by the way.
So, I mean, I'm stoked. I don't even know what to say about this thing other than a trailer's a trailer and whatever. Trailers don't always do the film that it's trailing justice, but I felt like the first Avengers trailer kind of disappointing, the old one, but then that movie just owned me and I love it. This one is awesome, this trailer. I hope the opposite doesn't happen and the movie's no good, but I think it will be. And if this takes the dark turn that I think the Ultron story could take, I am all up in this and super stoked and very excited. Liam, are you a fan? Where are you at with these Marvel movies, man?
I mean, I grew up reading comic books, and we're living in our golden era. The only thing that I'm thrilled for the movie, and I can't wait to see it. The only thing that I found myself wondering watching it, and I'm not the first person to air this thought, is like a lot of movies these days with superheroes. I notice that they face a lot of sort of uniform faceless bad guys,
yeah,
robots, aliens, and I mean, that's the one element that doesn't, like, and I don't know the Age of Ultron story from the book, so I sure. I don't know as much
that
as
makes
that.
A difference, although in the case of just the faceless minions he seems to have,
yeah,
I have to admit I had the same kind of reaction, and I've read a lot of the Ultron stuff, I'm no student of it by any means, but mm-hmm. when they all come flying out of the water and flying up in the air, I just kind of went, oh, like the last dudes who came up out of space, or like any number of dudes that were in the Thor movie, or, you know, they're kind of these faceless alien looking things that feels like a bit of a trope that they lean on. So I don't,
you're tired of overwhelming force.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know if I, yeah. I don't know.
I'm
if
sure
I,
there's going to be great interaction between, you know, our leads. It's just, I just hope that as we have so many of these movies coming out for the next decade, that it doesn't become every film or every other film that it's some horde.
Well, I spoke to the person on the couch next to me as if Tom was sitting there, and I said these words. So Tom, now you can finally respond. When I saw this trailer, I said, there's lots of subtext happening here. So the Hulkbuster suit and the square off with the Hulk, that's not a thing that is just automatically, oh, that's just part of this Ultron story. No. There's more nuance to it than that. So that, whatever that is and why that's happening, I really want to know. There's a very brief moment where the Hulk is putting his hand up against Black Widow's in a gesture of sort of, I guess, softening the beast, if you know what I mean. Actually, that sounded like a human doing it.
I thought they were just comparing
how
big their hands were.
Yeah, maybe. It's like, ooh, yours are bigger than mine. That kind of thing gets me more excited than any of it, because that says there's a bunch of deeper stuff happening. There's subtext that is a specific to some of these characters in unique ways. Like, that's what makes me excited, not an army of robots.
That's why that Io9 breakdown was so interesting, because it picked up on a lot of things that I didn't notice just watching the trailer all the through, because they went frame by frame. And there are a lot of hints that Bruce Banner ain't going to have a good time in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, him sitting and kind of quivering on the floor, that looked bad.
Yeah.
I don't know what's Andy Serkis doing in there? What's his deal?
I don't know.
So we don't know if he's playing it. Well, obviously he's playing somebody because he's him.
Eagle or Gollum. We don't know.
Or it's a 50-50.
Yeah, it could go either way. I've seen 13. I've seen 13 going on 30. I know what he can do. I don't know. I find myself giddy
it's
about
pretty
it.
Dark, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's really exciting. And I'm hoping there's one. Jenny Josephson, our producer on Daily Tech News Show, was saying, I missed the Whedon-esque humor. So we're hoping there's another trailer coming, which I know there's another trailer coming, but we hope in the next trailer we get a little bit of, even if it's still dark, we still get a little of that quippy humor, because man, this one didn't have any of that.
But isn't this also just always your second chapter kind of thing? You know, Empire Strikes Back of your trilogy, where things get a little dark and grim for a while.
Hulk, I am your father.
I think we can feel pretty confident that the quips will come in. But I'll also add that despite my reservations about the army of robots, that I loved the presentation of Ultron and Spader together. It's just different than any sort of sentient computer intelligence or artificial intelligence that I've ever seen. It's very different than anything we've seen in the past.
Yeah, it's creepy. He makes you want to be afraid of him. And Spader is such a weird pick. Like, it does seem a little out of left field when you heard the announcement. It's like, oh yeah, Spader's going to be voicing the the Ultron character. And the trailer does lead us to believe that they're going to pull away from the comic core story, which was Ant-Man. Hank Pym built the robot. That's where Ultron came from, and then all hell broke loose. In this story, it does appear to me that maybe what we're looking like is one of Tony Stark's models went a little nuts. Maybe this may have something to do with Jarvis going a little crazy. Like, I don't know exactly, but it does seem to be a very different origin than the Hank Pym origin. I'm totally fine with that. What I didn't expect was the creep factor and the kind of menacingness of just this short trailer and a few lines of dialogue. But it's enough to just make me go, ooh, dude.
Well, that whole Pinocchio song thing was creepy.
Yeah.
It did make me think too much about copyright and the fact that, like, oh, yeah, because Marvel's owned by Disney, they get to use that. Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
Still a
nice
good use, though, don't you think?
But, yeah, it was well played. Yeah.
What did we see mid-trailer? That was one of Tony's messed-up suits standing up and talking to them.
It looked like it. I don't know. That voiceover may have been a separate thing, and it just kind of it made it seem like it was coming out of that thing. But that's
I bet we're going to get a Hank Pym reference in this.
You think so? To lead into Ant-Man.
Yeah, because they're doing an Ant-Man movie.
Yeah.
So this would be the perfect place to set up the, you know, because that's what they've done through all of this, right? Is they'll start leaving breadcrumbs in earlier movies to kind of lead you to the future movie. It would be weird for them not to hint around that Pym was involved somehow.
Sure. But people complaining, I have this much to say to some complainers before we move on. Complaining that they're using this Disney song for a character, Pinocchio, which is not a Disney character, but for all intents and purposes, they sort of own that now in terms of the hearts and minds, right? They own the song. Right. They own the song, but they also, I mean, if you say Pinocchio, you think the Disney one, you don't think the ancient tale it's based on. I would argue that, yes, it's convenient for them that they own it and they can just use it. And that obviously must have played some kind of role. It had to have. But it's just perfect. If you know what this Ultron thing is, it's perfect for that.
It's extremely effective.
Yeah.
If Disney hadn't pushed for excessive copyright law that will protect intellectual property for 90 years plus the life of the author, I wouldn't think it'd give a second thought about it.
I know.
It has nothing to do with the usage of the Pinocchio song.
Yeah, you're too close to the situation is what's happened here. Because weren't we talking last week?
I think about it whenever I watch Once Upon a Time, too.
I know.
I'm like, oh, yeah, I get to do that.
Right. But, I mean, it's so funny because you were saying, I think, last episode, how Disney, they farmed mostly open source old tales that nobody can copyright,
like Pinocchio, exactly.
And yet they fight for this like they own them. It's very odd. It's a very odd thing, but excited nonetheless. Let's get there.
Let's bring robots into the real world. Enough of this imaginary Ultron stuff. In a production of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, the lead role, which if you know the story is a guy who turns into a giant insect, is being played by a robot. And in fact, in this adaptation, the play's director, Oriza Harada, substituted a robot for the bug. It's a Japanese-French production, so it's being played in French. So instead of turning into a bug, the main character turns into a robot. Mm. Hiroshi Ishiguro, who developed the Replier S1 for the part, made sure it can smile and laugh and worked in collaboration. You can catch it in Yokohama, Japan this week or Normandy, France in November during that region's autumn festival.
So it's not a autonomous robot, though, right? I mean, it's just a puppet, really. They're controlling it.
It has strings on it. That's what you're trying.
Things go really awry when it stands up and begins to slaughter the entire audience.
Yeah, that's what you're worried about.
I've got no part.
But it's funny when people say, because I like the idea in the fiction of the play that it's a robot. That's an interesting twist. It just seems like the articles, and this isn't the first I read about this, they all seem to be pointing at this idea that the role is being played by a robot, and it's not really being played by a robot.
I almost feel like that's kind of beside the point, right? It is being played by a robot. Whether the robot is an AI that is like coming up with the expressions on the fly or not is sort of immaterial to me. Like step one is this is a robot that has expressions, and whether it's programmed to do all of the pieces individually or coming up with it on the fly, I mean, that would just be icing on the cake to me if it could do that.
So is Kermit the Frog a robot then?
No, but Kermit the Frog is directly controlled by a human being and also doesn't have facial expressions very much.
Yeah, fair point.
It's an evolution. I mean, it's an evolution that's been going on a long time, starting with Pinocchio or, you know, Bunraku Japanese puppet theater. And it's just getting more advanced the further we go. So I'm sure in another 100 years, if we're still here, there will be very intelligent robots on stage for, you know, not for everything. They're not going to get rid of entire productions of actors doing King Lear, but I feel like it's becoming more and more part of our civilization's story. It's brand new. Mm. And the longer we are here and move forward, it's going to get implemented more.
Liam, I feel like you and I, because we're fathers, we have this shared notion that in 100 years, humanity might be not here anymore. I've noticed this about guys who have kids. Have you noticed
I'm
that?
Pretty skeptical.
All right. I just wanted to check because if
that's an evolutionary advantage, right? Yeah. You gotta plan for the worst.
I guess so. And then when you do, you increase the survivalhood of your kids and their kids.
It's going to be bad. Yeah. All I've got is a box of rations and a hobbit sword, and I don't know how well that's going to do.
Oh, jeez. Good luck, man. Hobbit sword in L.A. when it's being overrun. That's going to be bad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good luck.
I guess the big story with this is that it's the lead role in the play.
I guess so. Yeah. But, there's still, you know, none of these things that the thing is doing are happening without someone behind the stage is making it time when it needs to happen.
Well, that's why I compared it to a puppet. That's the case. I get the feeling that this is just programmed. It's not like a puppet where someone's like speaking into a microphone and making it say something in reaction.
But can it adapt to the other actors if they, let's say, they screw up or forget a line or
I don't know,
go left and they should have gone right. So that's where
you're just not easily impressed.
I'm not, especially
today.
Robot just
got a lead part in a play, and Scott's like,
this guy's terrible at it. He's terrible at improv. Can we get somebody else?
Fair point,
yeah, this
you
is
make.
Not an improv. That's
you're supposed
sure.
to say yes and.
Yeah. Well, we all know the real threat is Google, and our next story makes that more or something.
SwiftPaw submitted this story. Google has acquired deep learning outfits Dark Blue Labs and Vision Factory, which both spun out of Oxford University. Google's also partnering with Oxford, making a sizable donation to support wider research efforts in the area of AI. Some of those members of Dark Blue Labs and Vision Factory are going to continue to teach at Oxford, and the teams will join Google's DeepMind department and specialize in natural language understanding algorithms with help robots processing 3D objects and movement. We're all pretty much dead.
Yeah. So here,
you guys were like going there already with the actor robot and pick, and at the same time picking on him for being a Muppet. This is the stuff you need to worry about right here.
Sure. What's that movie that makes us want to think that Taco Bell is the great corporation of the future?
Demolition Man.
Yeah. Demolition Man. I don't think that's true anymore. I think that if we'd have made that movie today, it's a fun joke, right? That the Taco Bell is like the conglomerate that owns everything and still Taco Bell. Every day that goes by where I hear about Google building some new thing, self-driving cars, robots that do crap for you, even something simple and more immediate like glass, it just makes me think more and more than in 20, 30 years, because they're thinking so ahead on this stuff, they'll be the ones controlling the robot servants of the future or the whatever, and still saying do no evil or whatever their thing is. And I don't know, man, it makes me nervous. They make me nervous at Google. But maybe that's my fatherhood kicking in again.
Go read the article it's an excerpt actually of a book by what's his face from WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, talking about his meeting with Eric Schmidt, where he basically just walks you through from thinking that Eric Schmidt is a technocrat capitalist to thinking Eric Schmidt is trying to secretly run the world.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
All right. I'm in. Does Google make you nervous, Liam?
I kind of feel like it's inevitable.
Yeah.
But maybe if everything's going to hell, maybe they can create the cybernetic exoskeletons that our intelligence will need to survive.
Great.
And for that, I will bow and mine in their sugar mines.
At the same time, let's pull back to modern day.
Right? I love their sugar mines.
Yeah, that's okay. Awesome. Google can be. Google gets more and more frightening all the time. I'm not going to deny that. Yeah. But the AI research being done here at Oxford University, this is real stuff. This is good stuff. And this is the kind of thing that's going to change your world. I think that these are people who are doing what Scott was picking on the robot actor for not being able to do. These guys are like, yeah, I think we might know how to do that.
Yeah.
We can make it react and come up with stuff on the fly.
I'm trying to figure out why they'd need sugar though, Liam. Why would we be in the sugar mines?
Robots have very sweet teeth.
I love
everyone knows that.
Big
Scott.
Grasshopper robots, really, is what you're talking about. Great.
Bring me some more lemonade, Scott.
In the year 2000, the robots win.
I forgot about that voice you do. All right, well, tell me about hoverboards then. Since the future's coming, we may as well have
hoverboards. All right, fine. Like, the most significant advancement in artificial intelligence doesn't impress you, maybe a hoverboard will. Travis tipped us up off to the Hendo hoverboard being kickstarted by a company in Silicon Valley called Arx Pax. Husband and wife team, Greg and Jill Henderson, wanted to make buildings safer for disasters. They were especially inspired by the Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco. They also think this would be good against floods. Part of their research involved magnetic levitation, kind of like maglev trains, to make the buildings float a little so that they could be flexible. And rather than being stressed and broken, they could sort of react, like, almost like a shock absorber, right?
Yeah.
That led to developing smaller floating devices, which led them to make a hoverboard. Kickstarter is funded, but it's still ongoing. All 10 of the $10,000 a piece hoverboards are sold, but you can still get one of the $300 white box development kits. It's a smaller box. It still does float. You have to be operating all of these things over a particular type of metal, usually like an aluminum or a copper. So it's not like you can just go float out into the world. Everything arrives on October 21st, 2015 next year, which is intentionally the same day Marty McFly was foretold to ride a hoverboard in Back to the Future 2.
Perfect. That terrible movie. So I'm fine with this as an idea, and I've always wanted one, but the price is a little steep. Okay, whatever. We're on the cusp of it. Let the prices come down. That's fine. Time will tell on that. I'm more worried that these won't work unless you're over a specific kind of material, which leads me to think that the real application for this, if it does take off in any meaningful way, will be like kind of like a Disneyland of sorts, or a place like a park that's set up just for this and would have just that material.
Like a laser tag arena, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
because a cross between laser tag and like a skate park where you can go.
Laser shoe skate park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now you could see the reason. I mean, that makes perfect sense to me because these aren't going to be common transportation because you don't have that material everywhere, at least not yet. So when I'll really be impressed, here I go again. Okay, here you go. This is when Scott's really impressed. When this can just float over anything, because that's what we were promised in those movies, is that we could just hover on whatever material we wanted. Now, I saw the video of this thing in action, and I have to say, as crazy as this Kickstarter sounds, and although I also don't think 200 and whatever thousand is enough to do what they want to do, but whatever, it's pretty impressive to see, you know? Like, that's them floating on a board. Engadget or somebody, I think it was doing it. It's kind of intense.
Yeah, The Verge did it. Gizmodo did it. Everybody's taking it for a spin, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, all right. That'll be...
Didn't we just get punked about a hoverboard like 2 months ago online?
That was the fake one Tony Hawk was on, and then it turned out to be like faked up.
PR.
Right?
Okay.
Right. Well, no, it was that... Oh, wait. No, what? You're right. What was that? That was one that was purporting... Well, there was a couple of things because they had the... They had the one with Doc Brown, like in modern day, showing a hoverboard. Then they had that thing with them. And then there was another thing that I thought was serious, like another.
There have been other hover things. There's the guy who made his own hovercraft,
yeah,
et cetera. This is unique because it's actually making like hovering available for you to mess around with. Like that $300 like developer kit to
oh,
me.
Oh, dear.
Is you need to check that?
You know what it is? It's that it's because it all comes on computers now.
Yeah, exactly. No, I hate it when it does that. It does that on your computer now.
I'll tell you what that thing needs real quick. This I know we even have a story about iOS 8.1 and Yosemite and how they work together. But what would be really nice is a right up there in the taskbar on my computer. Give me the sleep or not sleep mode, the ignore mode right there.
Yeah,
and then we're done.
Mute it.
Piece of cake. Just let me mute it while I'm on shows and then turn it off when I don't. Because I love it otherwise. Totally rad. Anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. But you were saying hoverboards.
Well, I'm just excited about the fact that they're putting this technology out there for $300 for people to mess around with and come up with stuff, right?
Yeah.
The hoverboard thing is intentionally a marketing ploy to be like, hey, we can actually do this. Yeah, it's loud and it's expensive and it's not really practical. And honestly, that's not what we want. We want to save people from dying in an earthquake. But if this helps get attention on this and gets people excited and they buy this developer kit and they figure out other things, there's who knows what we can do with this technology. Mm. I mean, they have made an improvement on maglev trains already. Like that can be scaled to that. and put it in the hands of people and said, mess around with this. See what you can come up with. I think it's really exciting that people may start saying like, oh, I have the ability to levitate something over metal. What can I do with that?
Because it's easy to say, I mean, it's so easy for us to go, hey, look, we've fulfilled more Star Trek ideas by having smartphones, because basically that's what they had. And that was unheard of then. But look at us now. And the truth is, what we have now is so much more than what they had on Star Trek. On Star Trek, it was just mostly a two-way communicator. It wasn't anything special. It was like a CB radio that could transfer through a planet's atmosphere back to the ship.
It was a walkie-talkie.
Yeah, which isn't that, that's not really all that impressive. What's impressive is that from that, how far we've then gone from that basic functionality, which we've had since the 60s, really, or maybe even the 50s, and we've turned it into something truly outrageous by science fiction standards. And this would be probably the same thing. The end goal isn't, hey, I want a hoverboard. I think the end goal is, hey, there's this rad technology. That could be one use of it, but let's get it into the hands of creative, smart people and see what we really can do with it. So I agree with you. I have turned my opinion around. I'm all about hoverboards now. Here's my 10 grand.
I would like to see you on a hoverboard.
All right. You got it, buddy.
Okay.
I'm in.
You can still buy part of the Kickstarter to show up on October 21st. At the unveiling and then get to ride one.
Oh, see, that's pretty cool. That's like getting a Tesla car, because then they invite you to the like the D reveal and all that. Maybe they'll do that for when this thing's for real. I mean, I don't know. 10 grand is, part of me says that's super expensive. And then part of me says, if that's a thing that would work, that's way underpriced. Like that's crazy cheap. So I don't know. I've heard some say they think this thing's kind of a, not a hack or not a, not a fraud, but it's not the most,
there are other things that have done similar things, and it may turn out that this isn't the most practical use of it.
Sure.
But I think it's definitely real. It definitely works. And I think the criticism is, well, that's not really going to be a practical hoverboard. And they're right. It's not.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Like maybe it'll get approved for that, but that's not their point. Their point is we want to do interesting things with this technology, and we think we came up with something good.
There's probably
a couple other companies out there doing similar things that are really pissed that they didn't think about the hoverboard angle. That's all.
Mm. Yeah, good point.
It could eventually revolutionize transportation as we know it.
Yeah, quite literally would change it completely. And
it could take what maglev trains are right now and make them even more efficient and easier to put in. Maybe the United States will actually put some in.
Yeah. Maybe this is the impetus. Maybe maglev shoes are next.
Yeah.
Ah, look at this. Look at the brain
roads,
on this guy.
Where we're going, we'll need roads, actually. Copper roads, possibly.
I have maglev all over my body.
Hey, the BBC announced a game called The Doctor and the Dalek. It's voiced by Peter Capaldi. Went online October 22nd. That itself would probably be exciting enough for a lot of people. But it's actually a game meant to teach the basics of programming to kids. Or the young at heart.
Where can this be downloaded? Is it browser-based? I haven't heard much about this, actually.
No, I think you download it. You have to be in the UK, too, or appear to be in the UK. Because it's actually part of the BBC or British curriculum for teaching program.
Oh, that's interesting. I feel like we don't have, I mean, different institutions might hear, but we don't have much of a agreed upon focus on programming specifically, do we, in this country?
I don't know that that's true.
Maybe not. I mean, I don't know. I don't feel like, I'm literally basing this on my experience with my kids' schools now currently. And neither of them have a very strong focus on programming skills and languages and things like that.
Well, yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
No, I don't know that that's any different in the UK, but I think there is an agreed upon curriculum in several states for computer programming, whether it's implemented.
You're probably right. Yeah.
I was going to say that they certainly talk about it at my kid's school, but it doesn't feel like the kind of thing that's ingrained in our society yet, like standardized testing and math scores and reading scores, but it should be. I mean, I think about it all the time. If civilization doesn't teeter off into the ocean and we're gone, I figure that I need my kids to understand that. I mean, I think when I was a teenager, I thought, yeah, man, someday when I'm a dad, I'm gonna instill the same values that I had and get my kid to go to college. And now I don't know that that's true anymore. I don't know that I need to urge my children to go to college. I need them to probably get into programming.
Yeah, and it's funny because you say that in the same way I'll say it, and I'll say it with weird trepidation because it seems... The wrong word is sacrilege, but I'll use it to say things about traditional learning and education that seemed to fly in the face of everything we used to think was the core. And now the core is changing. And it used to be part of the core was you needed to learn some foreign languages. Now there's not nearly enough emphasis on that, at least schools here anyway. I can only speak for here. But when I was a kid, it was a big deal to learn Spanish or German or something. And now it's just like, meh, whatever, you can kind of if you want, whatever. And so I think it's interesting that what I hope is that we as a nation and other nations will accept the idea that feign-dangled programming is, yes, a kind of relatively recent construct of humanity, but it is a functional, skillful thing that is just as important for kids to learn, maybe more important than biology or how to type on a typewriter, although that'll sort of come with it. But you know what I mean? Like some of those cores, as important as they've always been, there's just this built-in resistance to something new like this, this thing that seems like it's, you know, it's meant for, I don't know, it's meant for temporary, or it's not really part of what our core should be. And, you know, that's hard to do, I guess.
I think that's what this is meant to do. I think this is addressing that and saying like, hey, let's make something that appeals to kids, is popular, catches people's eye, gets them interested in it.
The thing like exterminate, does that get yelled in the program?
Oh, I can't imagine it doesn't.
I hope so.
That's, you program that in by level 3.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and that the conceit is apparently that the doctor has abducted a Dalek, and if he can get it working again, he'll be able to save the day. And so you have to help him reprogram it.
Is it,
and that's
like
how you start learning these programs.
That's like the Hugh episode of Next Generation. Remember that? When they got their own Borg and then put him back into the collective after they gave him a personality. And then he screwed up the collective.
There was an episode this season of Doctor Who actually very similar to that. I'm sure that's what they pulled it from.
Probably.
Can I just say I'm amazed at how young people are really into Doctor Who. I feel like I don't know anything about Who. It's like one of the holes in my nerd credit card.
Yeah.
And can I get my nerd credit card, please? But when I go to my kids' school, they have like a reading section at school about it. They base class projects on Doctor Who. I feel like it snuck up on me.
Yeah. I feel the same. I mean, Tom's a big nerd about it and has been for decades, right? But I've been
shocking.
So slow to, I still haven't really gotten into any of the new stuff. Seen maybe 2-3 episodes since Eccleston hopped in and they started that thing over. And I've seen some old ones, and Tom and I watched the pilot, which was this weird film / 20-minute, I don't know, it was the weirdest thing. And
well,
I
that was the original from the 60s.
Sure, right? Sure. But that's that it right there, and that and a couple of weird Tom Baker episodes when I was a teenager, that's about as much as I've ever seen. And I'm constantly getting ridiculed for it by my nerd friends, but I would love to get, it just feels so huge and so scary to get in.
Well, and I think the reason it's gotten popular with kids is the reboot. It's not exactly a reboot, but the relaunch with Chris Eccleston has become very popular. And I don't feel people need to go back and watch the classic series to enjoy the new series. Mm-hmm. What I did, because I had seen the classic series and I was sort of a fan, but not as nearly as deeply into it as I was in Star Wars or Star Trek. But once the new series came and I started watching it and I was excited, I went back and I started filling in the gaps of things that I had never seen, especially things from like the Patrick Troughton and John Pertwee era before I was a kid. And that was fun. So I think you can just start, Scott, just start with the modern series. Just
start
like
with
you
Eccleston
would with
and go forward. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'm in. And you know what, Liam, we should do it together and then occasionally get together and have a little short podcast about how we're
hey,
doing.
And don't move right, it on Ralph out. And Kim. And
oh, yeah.
Johnny
that's what
Christ
they're doing. I forgot. That's the whole point of their show, isn't it?
I almost feel like the people around me are speaking another language. Like I understood 50% of what you just said to me, Tom. The names are flying by. I don't know.
Yeah,
I said Patrick Troughton and John Pertwee. I think those are the only things I said that were Who specific.
Yeah, Tom Baker. Someone's wearing a
then
scarf.
Then you dive down into a cloud and just stop listening.
Yeah. Like, yep.
There's a blue police box involved somehow. Anyway.
Google has a new police box. Actually, it's not. It's an email app called Inbox. It's kind of confusing. Because they already have an email app called Gmail, and this one works with Gmail and only Gmail, but its features are different. It's a different interface. It includes bundles, a way to group similar types of emails together like receipts, so it just does it automatically, or your travel stuff. Highlights, which flag the user to upcoming events, so it's got some Google Now magic in there. You can do things like reminders, assists, snoozes. So if an email comes in, you're like, I want to deal with that later, you can snooze it. And it's available cross-platform, iOS, Android, and the web, although the web version is only available in Chrome.
So this does not, to clear some confusion up about this thing that some people have, it does not replace Gmail. This is a different
thing. It doesn't replace
thing.
It. It's just a different way of accessing it.
So some people are flipping over themselves, just cannot wait to try this. And I hear about it, and I feel like it's kind of esoteric and kind of like a hippie app. Like, it's just sort of like, yeah, man, we're just going to give you what you need.
Today.
I am. I'm kind of enjoying this.
Hey, with your hippie inbox app.
But you know what I mean? It's all like hipstery and kind of, we're going to tell you what you want to see. And it's it just doesn't feel like a really productive thing for me. It seems like it might be neat, but is it really going to help me get through email better and be more productive? I don't know. What's your take, Liam? What do you think about inbox?
I have no time for anything, so I will probably continue to use Gmail.
That's why you need inbox. Because it can help you manage your email and save you time.
Sure. Okay. That's
what Google would say if you were to tell that to them. Yeah. I've been using it, actually. I finally got invited in yesterday, I guess. And it's going to be really helpful for people who use email in a particular way. Yeah. People whose inbox is essentially their task list. Mm-hmm. And they've just got scads and scads of emails in their inbox. Especially the mobile version, they'll find this very helpful. Because it thinks for you. It's not hipstery at all, Scott. Mm-hmm. Basically, what it says is like, hey, we noticed that all of these things are related to travel. So we're going to take those out of the inbox and put them in a little bundle called travel. And when you're ready to think about your travel, you look there. And these are all related to purchases. And so we're going to put them there. It's Google Now-ing your inbox for you. And then it lets you make tasks. It lets you set reminders. So if you're somebody who uses your inbox as a task list anyway, this is just like, oh, these are great. These are extra tools. These are amazing. Same team who made Sparrow apparently worked on this. So if you liked Sparrow, you'll probably like this. But if you're like me and you try to be like inbox zero, I'm not using my inbox as a task list. I'm not sure it's going, you know, if that's your goal anyway.
Yeah, that's me too.
I'm not sure that it really is good for you. Actually. Yeah,
that's me as well. And that's maybe why it's not ringing all my bells or whatever. I love new stuff and I will try this. How do the invites work? Is it just Google giving them out kind of piecemeal, or do you have to have a friend who has it and then they invite, or how's it work?
You know, it's interesting. The way I got mine was I emailed inbox@google.com, which is what I'd read the day it was announced. They're like, just email this email and we'll put you in the queue to get an invite. Yeah. So I did that and it worked. But apparently there are invites you can give if you're in it, but I can't find any. I may just be looking in the wrong place.
They don't trust you with that.
Yeah. It seems like all the big companies are doing this. They're taking like, all right, we've got all this data and information. We're going to scramble it around and put it together like this. Do you want to use it like this? Like when Facebook came out with its Messenger app saying, here, use this to message, even though you're using it to message.
Yeah.
See how they can better serve.
I think that's some of the worry I have though is like, Liam, you could send me an email saying, Scott, I have to travel to Phoenix, but before I go, I just wanted to ask if you had a good recipe for lasagna. Okay, that's your email. Mm-hmm. I worry that it would go into the travel pile. I realize their algorithms are better than, oh, the word travel's in there, put it in the travel pile. But you know how Google is. Like, even Gmail with its separating of main inbox and then the two
promotional
ones.
Well, you can still
ones.
See emails for today, right? You know? Like, the if you're worried about missing an email, if you don't have too many emails already, you're not going to, right? The bundles are a separate thing to organize the stuff.
Yeah.
And help you get there.
And I get a lot of emails about Warcraft. Is it going to say like, you should buy Warcraft? Here are five places to buy it. I mean, obviously I've got the wrong impression.
I don't see
of this
any
thing.
Ads in here.
There are no ads? Okay. I was curious about that. Because, you know, ultimately that's where their money is. But
exactly.
I really want to try it just because I want to see if it's something I would want to do. But my productivity side of things are so out of my email that I don't know that this will do anything for me, especially, I mean, maybe on the desktop because that's where a lot of my production gets done. But who knows? It's coming. Get ready to receive it, everyone.
I think all we know is that all roads lead to Ultron.
Right on. Where there are no strings. All right.
Finally, iOS 8.1, as we mentioned, came out on Monday. Brings back the camera roll, enables handoffs that we heard demonstrated earlier, and it lets you use Apple Pay. Payment system is set up in Passbook. So you go into Passbook settings if you want to add a credit card. You can use your iTunes default card. You can add other cards. Not every card works in it. And then what it does is it creates a token on your phone that is used to identify you as the owner. And then the near field communication chip in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus can transfer that token to a credit card terminal. That terminal says, oh, this token, I'm going to send it to the credit card processing company. The company recognizes it. The transaction is then done entirely with the bank. So your personal information is not stored on the phone. It is not transferred to the terminal. It's basically like having a unique credit card number for every time you make a purchase. And even if that number was taken by somebody, they wouldn't be able to use it anymore because it would expire immediately. Yeah. 220,000 locations in the U.S. can now accept Apple Pay, as well as a bunch of apps.
Like in-app purchases and all that stuff, yeah. Right? Liam, have you tried it yet?
No, I didn't know that it was. I mean, I think I vaguely knew that it had rolled out. I want to, though, a lot.
Yeah.
How long has it been live? Just a day or two?
Monday, right?
Monday, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it's been about a few days. And Tom, I know you went to like Whole Foods or something.
Yep. Got your seat right here.
You done anything, there? Anything since?
Nope. Maybe I'll go to McDonald's tonight for dinner.
Hey, look at that. I'm a healthy eater.
Try to use Apple Pay on my chicken McNuggets.
I practically live at Whole Foods. I'm going to load that on my phone tonight.
Well, I was like, basically, what merchants near me you will use Apple Pay? Whole Foods, McDonald's were the two closest. Mm-hmm. So I went to Whole Foods because it's a tiny bit closer. Mm. I live in a weird neighborhood. We have a McDonald's near a Whole Foods. Kind of unusual.
That is a little weird, right? Yeah.
So I haven't tried it elsewhere. But when I tried it at the grocery store, man, it was crazy. I talked about this on Daily Tech News Show, but I walked up. I had three oranges and a chocolate bar. And I'm just like, I want to use my phone to pay. And she got kind of excited. She's like, oh, you're the first one to do this. Hold on. She turns around. I see on my phone, because I already had Passbook open, that it says, would you like to pay with Apple Pay? I'm like, oh. Okay, so the terminal already recognizes me. I put my thumb on the Touch ID, and it said, okay, your payment has been accepted. And putting the thumb on the Touch ID was my way of saying, yes, I am paying that amount for that thing. And then when she turned back around, she had two more clerks with her. She's like, okay. And I'm like, I think it already did it.
Yeah.
And one of them leans over and goes, oh, yeah, yeah. You just got to do the normal thing. And so she's like, oh, okay. And then she presses a button, brings me up. I'm done.
So it's easier than the store lady even thought it was going to be. That's amazing.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool. And I know a lot of other phones have had similar stuff to this.
Yeah, Google Wallet can be like that sometimes. My experiences with Google Wallet have always been a little more like, it didn't go through, hold a little closer. But those were also in the early days of Google Wallet. I think NFC has been perfected a little better and these terminals are a little better.
Sure. Plus, weren't you telling me Wednesday there Google's the processor in those cases, whereas in this case,
is a difference, right? Know. It's a benefit, right? Because Google Wallet can then be available to more people because it says, I'm just going to process the payment myself as a payment processor, like a PayPal or an Amazon.
Right.
Whereas Apple's saying, we're going to be on the security side and the ease of use side.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Good, exciting stuff all around. You know what time it is, don't you? Why, it's this.
America scores and wins.
All right. It's time for the pop quiz. And that means Liam Junior O'Brien. I don't know your middle name. What's your middle name?
Christopher.
Christopher. Oh, lovely. I like that. your chance to put yourself up against, I guess, the history of this show and who came before you and see how well you do with your trivia thing. Now here's the deal.
If you get already schwitzing.
You should be. If you get it right, you get this. If you get it wrong, and Tom will add it up and then you'll see how your score is at the end of this thing. Here is your quiz. It is voice over trivia. It is career stuff that you've done. So these are all things you've done. Here's your first question.
Yeah.
What two characters by name did you play in the World of Warcraft expansion Mists of Pandaria?
The Shah of Violence and Derpa Derp McFlurka Derp.
That is correct.
You were right. You were right on the first one. Shah of Violence is correct. The other one was Chi Ji the Red Crane.
Oh, see,
of course. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Nice.
I was testing you, really.
Nice job. I remember beating the Shah and thinking, I think that was Liam. Tom, I want to split that one, but I'll leave that up to you there.
Sorry. 1 point. Gets 1 point.
Fair
enough.
Should
have had two.
All right, here we go. Next question. What character was voiced by you in Halo 4?
Spartan guy in a helicopter who drops people off.
That was almost like a song. I like that a lot. Shadow Leader was the name.
Sure.
Close enough. Sure, why not?
Maybe a tenth of a point, because that was kind of entertaining to hear you sing.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. I hope the whole rest of this is like this. All right, next up. In which game did you play Dr. Richard Levy?
Oh, that was in Alien Colonial Marines.
You are correct. Nicely done. That game was kind of terrible, but you were great in it, as always.
Why, thank you.
Who did you play in Iron Man and Captain America Heroes United?
I played the Red Skull.
Yes, you did.
I played Red Skull in a few places now.
This is what we should do, is have you do the voice at the end of each one of these. I mean, the one Elijah. You remember. That's so awesome. All right. According to IMDb, what is listed as your first voice acting credit?
Jeepers. I remember my first voice acting job was Boogie Pop Phantom.
That was the name of the character? Or was it a movie?
No, that was the show.
Oh.
The character's name was...
Iceworm getting technical. Yeah, saying, he according is. To IMDb.
Yeah, IMDb, which means that it may not be the accurate first credit.
Yoshi?
You are incorrect. It was Pat Labor, the movie.
Pat Labor.
What the hell is
that? That's
Pat
the one Labor? Where everyone said, ka, 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 right?
All right, yeah. So every anime ever I've seen? All right. Let's see. Next to, no, three more questions.
Well, you're getting a half point for that, by the way, on a technicality.
Yeah, I liked it.
This is all good. Okay, what unit is voiced by you in StarCraft II, Wings of Liberty, and Heart of the Swarm?
Oh, Terran Ghost.
Man. You are correct. The Terran Ghost is correct. I kind of gave that away earlier, but yeah, that's all right. You played the role of Caius Ballard, in what video games?
Final Fantasy 13 and 13-2.
You are correct.
33?
Yeah, yeah, it's totally
two
right.
Points.
Yeah.
13-2 is hard to remember.
Finally, this is so dumb. All right, I'm going to read it anyway. These are prepared by Iceworm. Here's your final question. What would Illidan Stormrage have to say about your preparation for these trivia questions?
You are not prepared.
There you go.
Dummy.
I like how Illidan goes, dummy.
Dummy.
A little up stick at the end.
That was
it's
awesome.
Me feeling out the snowball mic for what I should be using a full-on professional mic to do.
Ah, very nice. I saw it in the picture. Looked good. Looks like a nice mic to me. All right, he's done. Tom, how'd he do? And again, I don't know who to compare him to, but you know.
Well, I was going to compare him to the chat room, and the chat room was throwing out some answers, but none of them were correct. 0 points to the chat room today. Sorry, Tadpool.
Suck on it, Tadpool.
Yeah.
And so the winner with 7.6 points is Liam.
Whoa, that's high, actually, just
it
on
is
average.
High.
Yeah. We don't normally, people do not end quite there. And we can't count that one where people had thousands of points at the end, whatever that was.
Well, why not?
Well, because sure.
That seems like a higher number than what I got.
Yeah, I think 1,000 is a higher than 7.
Yeah, but that was like scored by monkeys. That was the weirdest episode of this show.
I don't think I'm a monkey. Well, I guess depending on how you look at it, maybe.
That was totally
all of them
fun.
Are scored by monkeys.
I love
so
that.
It would be exceptional.
It was also a good excuse to get Liam to do a couple
eights,
of voices.
Really,
which,
not
yeah.
monkeys.
Yeah, no, come on, let's get it straight. All right, that leads us into this right here.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
All right, by gum, it's the forecast segment. It used to be a show. It's now a segment, and it's where we try to predict the future, usually in technical and geeky ways. And I had one today, and I don't know. This actually came up because somebody's actually developing a system that works with the Oculus Rift and other VR technologies, specifically that new Galaxy Note 4 setup that Oculus did, where you could conceivably host a podcast. So imagine Tom and I hosting a podcast. We don't even have to be in the same room, you and I, but let's say we were. Let's say you're just across from me by 10 feet or something on another mic. And the way this would work is live and archive viewers and listeners of the content could come in with their VR headsets virtually into that space and walk around us, get all close to us, sit by us, ask questions if that's what you wanted them to do, except in the archive, obviously. That this will be as janky as I think their initial stab at it is, and it will be because the tech's not quite there. All these things take an amazing amount of coordination, and it's all very kludgy. But in the future, some far-flung future, the talk show format will be in virtual rooms with virtual hosts who are actual people, but will all be virtually within, you know, proximity of one another, and people can come and hang out and watch live or otherwise. And we've talked about how this may inject itself into actual other kinds of entertainment, dramas and things where you could walk around the scene that's happening. But it's similar to that, but it would be, you know, imagine Current Geek with a virtual audience. Crazy, good idea? I'll just give it to you guys. What do you think?
Well, are we talking, maybe you said this, but are we talking VR goggles so that you're in and you're looking around, or are we talking about the sort of movie trope where everyone pops up like holograms in your living room?
It would be, oh, good question. I was thinking more like everyone's in goggles, and the only way to see the space is if you're wearing them and you're having that world projected to you as well. The other idea is interesting. It's kind of like how if there's a Jedi on vacation, that's how they got him in the meeting. Was they would you know, holograph in one of the weird aliens and say, all right, everyone's here. Great. Let's talk about Jedi stuff. I could see that maybe working. The problem with that is it always just felt like, or it would feel like, well, there's not a dude sitting there. That's a glowy, fake looking thing I can run my hands through. In this scenario, we might even have hitboxes, haptic feedback. Although that gets a little weird, but you know what I mean? Like you could smack somebody and feel it. You could sit down and feel, or, you know, hear the people next to you make a comment or
why
mute,
do we need to choose
or mute them? Well, you wouldn't. That's the point.
Is like, I think you could have it so that there's a certain number or maybe people with a particular ticket get to be the holograms that pop up while the recording is happening. And then other people are only viewers in their headsets, so they can only see, and they'll be able to walk around and touch and interact, but nobody else would see them.
Yeah, see, I'd be down with that, and that seems interesting. Like, that seems like a really fascinating way to get... I feel like it might... Here's the question, though, or I may be arguing against my own prediction here. But it seems like there might be a problem with being distracted. So, in other words, if you're there to hear the content... and watch them and hear them and, you know, have this, even if it's not a two-way conversation, but at least, you know, soak in what they're saying. But you could get up and walk around and not bother anybody. And it would just be this, you know, thing where you could come knock a pencil off this virtual desk I'm sitting at or whatever. Wouldn't that just be, you're not really paying attention. And you're doing things that you wouldn't be allowed to do in a real room with people because there's all kinds of social blocks for that. But in a virtual space, who's going to stop you? Because everyone,
or,
as we know, is an ass.
Walking right up inside everybody's personal bubble space
right.
with the simulations of them, just like getting right in up against Dave Letterman's forehead.
Exactly. And why? Because why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they get, you know, why wouldn't they hump his left arm for no reason? Why wouldn't they throw a plastic penis across the room if they could conjure such a thing?
So what if they do?
I don't know. Does it? I guess
I mean,
so.
If they're the only one who sees it.
Well, what if the whole? Oh, good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
Right. There'd be no haptic feedback on Dave Letterman's forehead.
Yeah,
it's generally penis. What I do when I watch Letterman now. You just don't know.
Tom's got his head right on the screen as he comes out on stage. Well, okay, fair enough. Answer me this riddle then. So I was having a conversation with a friend about what it would mean, because here's a very common use for VR. Even now you can do it. There are apps out there that do this. You can go into a virtual movie theater, sit down in your seats, and up in front of you is a big, giant 70-millimeter screen playing your movie. And if you turn away from it, just like in a real movie theater, you're turning away. You got fake popcorn in your lap. There are potentially people sitting next to you. It's a big, fully rendered space. And then he said, well, what if there's only one really perfect seat in the entire house? And I said, well, it wouldn't matter since it's virtual reality. It's all fake. You could just, whoever's in there could just always have that seat. And he said, but wait, if I'm sitting next to you in this virtual space, how is it you have the seat and I have the seat at the same time? Kind of made a good point. Is it possible? This is kind of totally unrelated. But do you think it's possible to be able to fill a room with 50 people and have them all feel like they have the perfect seat, yet have the context of we are all in this room together still work?
Well, yes. Maybe the virtual movie theater is so large that it becomes irrelevant since your group of 50 is in this tiny little spot in a much larger arena.
That's a good point. Or maybe the screen is positional so that wherever you're sitting, the screen is center to you.
Yeah.
And that looks right to you, I guess.
Exactly.
But I don't know why I find the question so fascinating. I think there's maybe something wrong with me because the idea that you could construct a space to feel like real physical space yet have it be your space.
That's the advantage of virtual reality is you don't have to mimic reality, right?
Right.
What blows your mind is like, yeah, but if I wanted to build a theater where everybody had the perfect seat, it would be really difficult. And it's like, well, that's fine. Now, it doesn't matter in a virtual reality, just you take the screen out of the equation. So okay. The relative positions are all the people sitting.
Right.
So I'm sitting next to Scott, Liam's on this side. But when we look at the screen, that's a different rendering for each one of us. And it doesn't matter that it's a different rendering because every rendering is a different rendering.
Right.
So we can keep Liam and Scott still in the same positions next to me in the screen in front of me while Liam sees the screen in front of him and me next to him and his wife next to him or whatever, right?
Well, then it only gets weird if somebody goes in wanting to sit in the far bottom corner that gives you the worst view ever and actually wants that view. Do you know what I mean? And I guess they could get that if your thing has options for that.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't know why.
Could make that.
I don't know why that scenario is so interesting to me, but it just is. And I'm super stoked about all this VR stuff.
Well, then going back to the talk show, I think that's the key is like, do you want to have the I'm in the talk show for real experience where you can see other people, in which case there would be rules and things you wouldn't be allowed to do? Or do you want the like free reign where I'm going to like be able to just kind of sit down on the couch next to Scarlett Johansson while David Letterman interviews her and be able to like look behind her and see what label is on her dress? And,
creepy VR is what that is.
Liam, well, I was just saying, you know, because you might want to buy it for your wife.
Sure. No, of course. Yeah. Perfectly.
That's how I took it.
I don't know, man. I mean, it seems like there's possibilities for all this stuff. And I, so the other angle I just wanted to touch on real quick is, so Liam, in your business and the world you exist in, VO is interesting from a preparatory, directed, recorded, edited, final product later kind of work, right? But It seems like we're getting toward a future where the idea of artificial characters either on screen or in virtual space being operated by professional voice actors and people who are also doing the body movements of these characters could be doing improv live stuff on stages where it's maybe projected or whatever the venue is. Do you or your cohorts ever talk about this kind of stuff?
We talk about it quite a bit. I mean, I wouldn't say every day, but I've had multiple conversations about this, about, you know, it ties into everything. The topics we talked about today all kind of had one theme to them. And I wonder with stuff like Ultron and what's the idol's name? Hatsune.
Oh, what's Miku, whatever.
Like we could at one point have a golem construct or a hero construct for a movie or a game or whatever it is.
Hatsune Miku.
Thank you. And
just saved Scott a couple emails.
Thank you.
And eventually, like at this point, we need one or two actors and animators to make that character come to life. But at a certain point, would you be able to take an actor out of the equation? Would you be able to have a computer so intelligent that it has studied 500,000 human interactions and can mimic them so well that a group of three animators could get their perfect performance from Gollum or from whatever they needed?
See, that's really interesting to me. Also, just from a performance perspective, I was listening to some really old Red Rider was what it was, some old time radio plays, and forgot that those were all live. Now that changed later in the late 40s and 50s. I started pre-recording a lot of stuff and whatever, but a lot of that stuff was live audience, uncut, and they were so good at it. And every once in a while, somebody would flub up a line and you'd go, oh, all right, well, yeah, this must have been live or whatever. I think that would be so cool in a more technologically advanced version of a live stage play, but that involved all of these artificial constructs, you in some room covered in ping pong balls being projected out there. Like, that's just so cool.
It would also demand that entertainers be better on the fly, like all entertainers, if that was going to be the case.
Yeah.
There's some people who can improvise, you know, amazingly and make it look like it's just like it's rehearsed or canon, they've got it, but some people just freeze up. And if that were to exist, you know, you'd have actors who'd go in that situation when the guy came over to sniff their forehead.
Right.
Watch Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good example. And this is not me predicting that one day we will not have edited, curated, you know, dramas and comedies. It seems like another facet that we could have some fun with. That's all.
This isn't a prediction, but one hope I have, my old man on the porch moment, is that I really love all kinds of audio. I spent a lot of time listening to podcasts and audiobooks. And when I grew up, I used to listen to Bill Cosby records constantly. And it's a medium that I still really, really love, while at the same time loving everything that's coming out of my PS4 and the movies right now and IMAX theaters. I think all that's amazing, but I hope that we don't in the same way that people are still producing Greek tragedies, that we don't get rid of all these different pieces of entertainment that we get that's just audio, because I still enjoy them a lot and would be sad.
I'm with you 100%. It's totally the thing I love the most. Video's great and all this stuff's great, but I hope that that form, and Tom and I have talked about this a ton of times, and people have opinions all over the place, and TV was supposed to be the death of radio, but I want to say that the reason it wasn't was because it never was going to be, that it is a form of information and entertainment and whatever else consumption that will just keep going. And I'm kind of banking on it. Like, that's my thing. That's what I want. It's what I want to make the most. Video's fine. Video's great. We'll put it that way. Video is
different
great.
Thing.
It's a different thing. Mm. And
you can't put on VR goggles and be in a virtual David Letterman show while you're driving.
No.
To work.
No.
Well, you should. Good. But you'll have a self-driving car, so it won't matter.
Right.
That's true.
Right.
Oh, shit. You're right.
Think of the nausea and disorientation, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's like that prediction people have that the internet will soon become a TV satellite service, essentially, and be nothing but video of everything. And I have to admit, there are times where I'll be like, shoot, I need to find out how to change a setting in Premiere I can't find. And I do a Google search, and when the top 40 results are videos that I can go try to see if any of them are good on YouTube, it's kind of disconcerting. I'm longing for the day where I just give me a like 5-step text-based blog post somewhere that isn't all videoed.
They exist. The problem is that like all the video people are like everybody's thinking video is where the money is. Mm. So you're getting more people making the video and working on their SEO for that.
Sure. I suppose that's true.
That'll go away, I think.
Well, what won't go away is emails and calls. By the way, we have a new hotline. You guys can call this number. Leave us a voicemail. We'll play them on the show. The number is 801-471-0462, 801-471-0462. Or you can email us at currentgeek@gmail.com. I got an email from Marlon who wrote in, says, "Hey, Scott, Tom, an awesome guest. I wanted to give you a heads up on the latest Humble Bundle title, Humble how would you say that?
Mobile.
Thank you. Mobile Bundle, meaning mobile. Anyway, it's Halloween-styled games exclusively for Android. Sorry, iOS fans. He says he so enjoyed saying that. And all six can be yours for just beating the average price of $3. Let's see. You can also get a free game just by visiting the page every 4 days. The promotion started on Wednesday the 22nd and is going to be live for 2 weeks. And more games are going to be added to the bundle next week on Wednesday. Check it out at humblebundle.com/mobile. This is from Marlon. It's a great suggestion. So I wanted to give some love. You know, we had all this iOS 8 talk and stuff. So here's some Android love, everyone.
It's $3.04.
The average went up. That's intense.
Yeah, it's getting up there.
I'm out. Just kidding. That's not that much.
4 cents.
Rebuild looks pretty cool. I might get that.
Yeah, it's all right. We're done. That's it. The show is over. But we don't leave without thanking our guest and saying how rad he was. So thanks, Liam, for being here, man.
You're rad.
Super cool, man. We loved having you on. Are there any projects or things going on that you are allowed to talk about that you can point people toward?
Just go play the hell out of Shadow of Mordor right now. Yeah. I am, in every second I have. It's pretty good.
It's really good. That game is awesome, and you're in it, and so are a bunch of your friends. And I would follow Liam on Twitter at Voice of O'Brien, because he'll post short little iTunes or iPhone videos of him and his voice actor friends playing D&D. It is a riot. And all we're getting is like 6-second chunks of it. It's insane. It's so much fun.
Well, you got a group of 9 people who spend every day professionally pretending to be different people.
Yeah.
Sitting around a table playing Dungeons and Dragons. So it's
doing voices. And
pretty good.
It's weird. You got Ellie from the Last of Us sitting right there next to you. You got freaking, what's his name? Dude from the new Second Son thing. I can't think of the name.
Right. Travis Willingham plays the brother in that. And then his wife, Laura Bailey, plays Fetch. Is that her name in the game?
Yeah.
The punk girl.
Yeah, the one that has her own DLC now, right?
We are half-elven twins.
Yeah.
it's a good time.
It's really funny. So people should follow you there. It's really good stuff. But thanks for being on, man. It was great.
Anytime. My pleasure.
Tom Merritt, anything from you, sir, before we go?
No, just reminding people Daily Tech News Show exists. Mm. So if you like more of the tech news, go check it out.
It's a great show. And I love it. And I like being a guest on it. And there are great other people on it. And people should listen to it. Why aren't you not listening to it, people? TomMerritt.com, DailyTechNewsShow.com.
You're not helping, Leon. Why aren't you helping? They're just questions.
That's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I want to thank Andrew Allen for our theme music. Also, Alpha Geek Radio for our live audio stream that we do each and every week. Again, that phone number to call, 471-0462, 801-471-0462. Current Geek, Scott Johnson, Ace Detect on Twitter, currentgeek.reddit.com, currentgeek@gmail.com, and currentgeek.com is our website. All those links are there. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and for Liam. We'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Jeannie, and I'm exploring some of the history of Westeros in Game of Thrones. Northmen usually refers to the people established in the region north of the Neck but south of the Wall, where the blood, traditions, and religion of the First Men still rule the culture. Because of their location, they face the heaviest brunt of Westeros' winters, which can last for many years at a time. Surviving winters for the Northmen is a daily life-and-death struggle. So much so, they guard and preserve their resources very closely. Because of this, they have fewer wars over petty feuds and lover's quarrels. Though conversely, they still have some internal competition over finite resources, such as a centuries-long rivalry between the Starks and the Boltons. As one of the few areas in Westeros with a foreign border, the North constantly deal with wildling raiding parties that circumvent the Wall. Every few generations or centuries, the wildlings are united behind a king beyond the Wall, who launches major raids on the South. And the Northmen are always the first in line of defense against them. Having to constantly fight for real, they consider tournaments to be frivolous waste of time and resources. Their lords adamantly uphold many laws of the First Men. For example, when a sentence of execution is passed, they wield the sword themselves. If a leader is unable to look a condemned man in the face when executing him, they are considered unworthy to lead. Many traditions of the First Men are also still in practice, like strictly observing the guest rite and laws of hospitality. When a guest eats or drinks beneath your roof, these rites and laws are invoked. Once that happens, neither the guest nor the host can bring harm to the other for the length of their stay. This holds true for all guests, not just nobles. This is considered a basic rule of all civilized men. Go to TyrionsLanding.com or TyrionsLanding on Gmail and Twitter with topic requests for future segments. The music used is by Kevin MacLeod.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we take a look at the new fad in class action lawsuits called pay-for-delay antitrust suits and whether these lawsuits will chill the overwhelming desire companies have to settle patent infringement and invalidity lawsuits. Back in 2008, AstraZeneca was embroiled in patent litigation over the wildly popular heartburn medicine called Nexium. Various generic drug makers wanted to invalidate the patents on this drug in order to jump into that lucrative market well before these patents would expire in late 2014. However, as many patent lawsuits do, this case settled before a final disposition on terms not disclosed to the public. But there's at least some evidence that this agreement included a large payment of money to Ranbaxy for the promise to drop the lawsuit and not make a generic version of Nexium until the middle of 2014. Now these former competitors in court are forced to defend together against a class action lawsuit in Massachusetts, claiming that this payment and delay of the generic release is in violation of the Sherman Act. Plaintiff drug stores and consumers are painting a picture of unfair gaming of the patent system by AstraZeneca by paying for a delay in the generic drug release, thereby artificially keeping prices on Nexium inflated for the final 5 or 6 years of their patent coverage. These pay-for-delay suits are a relatively new fad. It seems to imply that companies like Ranbaxy, who challenge the validity of a patent, cannot drop that suit because they must serve the interest of fair market competition and consumer protection. If a duty to the consumers is created by filing and pursuing a lawsuit to invalidate a patent, then any settlement or payment could end up leading to this type of claim, which means more patent litigations will fill court dockets for longer periods of time rather than being settled. The bottom line is, efficient and quick settlement of patent lawsuits reduces a major drain on the court system, and if this pay-for-delay theory works for the class action lawsuit against AstraZeneca, that's bad news for the marketplace generally. Nobody wins in that situation except the lawyers, and take it from a lawyer, that's not what you want to have happen. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and legal-themed questions as segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
Welcome to the Indie Investigations Indie Game of the Week segment. My name is James Bartholomew, and today I'm going to tell you about the one best indie video game released this week. I went into Devil's Dare expecting a cheesy game with subpar gameplay, and I was half correct. A beat-em-up game about four convention goers that stumble into zombie apocalypse, Devil's Dare is incredibly cheesy and cliche with its storyline. References to other video games are in your face and they don't stop. At the beginning of the game, a red fairy pops up and tells you to listen. This fairy is identical to Navi from Ocarina of Time, but red. Yeah. He gives the four characters powers and enables them to defend themselves from the zombies. One of the characters becomes the Master Sword, one gets Twin Sai, which is an obvious reference to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and by this point you can probably tell that the references are over the top and definitely out of control. To some people, this is a great form of humour and they love it. In my case, I find it tedious and unintelligent comedy. With that said, that's all personal taste. Comedy is a very personal matter, and what I find funny, you might not. I don't really like the Borderlands humour either, to give you an idea of where I differ. The gameplay, however, is totally solid. Keeping in line with the idea of a beat-em-up game, you're fighting zombies in waves as you move along the level. The four characters have different styles of combat, the one being slow, one being a tank, one having range damage, and the final doing melee damage. These zombies all have different attacks and abilities, and you have to dodge and stun to prevent them from hitting you. The combat is quick and features heavily two buttons, a basic attack and a special attack. Each character has three special attacks. When an enemy is low on health, the special attack allows you to fatality them. That's a hard word to say if you're not used to playing Mortal Kombat. And get more cash back for killing them. This cash mechanic is interesting as well. Taking from arcade games, if you die, you can spend your cash to get a comeback to life token once you've lost all your health. This turns the game into a bigger challenge and provides a serious rewarding feeling when you get to the end of the level due to, when you die, everything going away. Levels are selected as you go, and with each playthrough going in a different direction based on which level you choose. This adds the ability to both see more content easily, and serves as a way to continue playing the game when you just can't take a hard boss anymore, but you want to keep playing, so you select a different level. Speaking of these bosses, they're kind of silly. So far I fought the Terminator and Jason Voorhees, which obviously proves the designs of these characters very unimaginative. With that said, the fights themselves are difficult, and make you use all of your character's abilities in defeating them, and challenges the player. The music's good, and evokes the feeling that the rest of the game is trying to get through to you, of playing an old-school arcade game. The same feeling comes across through the art style. Devil's Dare is a great game to play if you're missing the beat-em-up styles of yesteryear, and does a good job of emulating that old arcade feel. Just keep an eye out for those references, and please, you know, they're there, and you won't miss them. I am @Iagoros on Twitter, and you can find more of this content at www.initiativechecker.com. This was a small segment of Indie Investigations, a podcast that interviews indie game devs about the development process and what it's like to make a game. All my music is written and performed by Johnny Feinstein. You can email indieinvestigations@gmail.com if you have anything you'd like to add or ask. Thank you very much for listening, and have a fantastic week.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.